voices of the Middle East.
Good evening, you're listening to Voices of the Middle East on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is Gudar Zaktadari, your host. Tonight's show is a pre-recorded program of a forum hosted by American-Iranian Friendship Council on campus of Portland State University. The speakers in order are Professor John Damis, Director of Middle East Studies Center at Portland State, Dr. Catherine Thomason, President-elect of Physician for Social Responsibility, and myself. For more information about the American-Iranian Friendship Council, you can check out their website at www.aifcpdx.org. AIFCPDX.org. This program was recorded on July 20th, 2006. I hope you enjoy the show, and we'll see you next month. Thank you.
Heading toward a possible crisis in relations between not only the United States but other European countries and Iran. And for the past few years, there's been a looming confrontation. Let me try to lay out the elements, what it's all about, what directions it has taken, and what are the elements that might influence where it goes from here. The basic issue is the enrichment of uranium by Iran, and the Iranian position is that because it signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that goes back to 1968, came into effect in 1970, under that treaty it has the right to develop nuclear power for peaceful purposes, nuclear power plants like those we have in the United States, for example. The difficulty comes in that there are a group of nations who say, if you look at the record in Iran's case, maybe that's not such a good idea. And what happened is that in 2003, an Iranian opposition group brought to the attention of the International Agency for Atomic Energy that Iran had hidden for a full 18 years, from 1985 to 2003, some of its nuclear activities. The Non-Proliferation Treaty demands full cooperation with the International Atomic Energy Agency to show everything you're doing so we can monitor it so that it ensures that it is for peaceful purposes. So there are some members of the international community who would take the position that Iran may theoretically have a right under the treaty, but since it was not in compliance, that's a nice diplomatic term. Some on the other side who don't like what's going on would say since Iran cheated for 18 years, it can't be trusted. So therefore, it has forfeited that right which other signatories have. Some of the European powers said, well, let's try an engagement strategy which will lure and induce the Iranians into voluntarily giving up this right of enrichment and try to find a way out of that. This was led by the Germans, the French, and the British. And in 2004, they put together a package which the Iranians accepted. The Bush administration didn't believe for a moment that Iran would give up its right to enrich uranium, but it said to the Europeans, go ahead, we won't oppose it. Good luck, we don't think it'll work. By the end of 2004, the Iranians said, the Europeans, you haven't delivered with all the stuff you said you were going to do, so we're backing out. And in January, by the end of 2005, And in January of this year, 2006, they announced they would resume enrichment of uranium. It's a somewhat technical field, but basically you enrich uranium to different levels, and it's done through centrifuges. They whirl very, very fast. It's in a gas form. And the initial stage of enrichment could be to 3 or 4%, and at that level of enrichment is useful for peaceful purposes, for reactors, for commercial use to generate electricity. If you keep the centrifuges going and you enrich to about 20%, then you have uranium for research purposes. And if you keep them going for a much longer time and you're up to 90% enriched uranium, and what they're talking about is isolating the, I think it's the U-235 isotope, maybe friends can help me out here, to a level of 90% enrichment, then that can be used for nuclear weapons. So, in March, the president of Iran, in great fanfare, announced that Iran had mastered the technique of enrichment to this initial level, this 3 to 4% level, which is useful for peaceful nuclear power. And it seemed to have had one, it has one set of 164 of these centrifuges, which whirl very rapidly. You get a cascading effect, and you get a modest critical mass. It takes many, 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 and many years to build up enough to be useful for nuclear weapons. In any event, moving forward, a coalition came together to offer Iran an even more powerful set of incentives to give up its right of enrichment. And this time, the United States joined. And so this group is now comprised of six, including the five members of the permanent, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, United States, Britain, China, Russia, and France, and the sixth is Germany. So the six came together during the spring, they hammered out, and it took a lot of back and forth, and the Bush administration made a big concession by saying, in a group, we'll actually negotiate with the Iranians, something they hadn't been willing to do since 1979. And so on June 3rd, the European Foreign Relations Representative, Javier Solana, presented this package to the Iranians. Complex, but the major elements are that it offers the Iranians light water reactors. That is, it's a kind of reactor which will produce the energy that Iran says it needs, but will not allow the enrichment of uranium that can then be used for nuclear weapons. It involves the dropping of certain economic sanctions and boycotts by the United States, which would allow American technology to be sold to Iran, and would allow the Iranians to buy airplane parts. Why is that important? It's important because the Iranians have a fleet of American aircraft, I assume they're Boeing, and since 1979 they have not had access to used parts. So what they do is they buy them on the international used parts market, and when a plane crashes, they blame the United States because it wouldn't sell them the proper parts. So that would end. The Iranians could buy used airplane parts. It would involve support for Iran's membership in the World Trade Organization, and something very important to the Iranians, any effort to take this matter to the Security Council would be suspended. Very important to Iran. So on June 3rd, the Europeans, with the Americans on board, presented this package to the Iranians and said, we expect an answer by the end of June. Now, the end of June came, and it dragged on a little more and a little more and back and forth in meetings. And the latest is that Iran has not given an answer, and it has announced that it will give an answer in about a month, that is by late August. Well, it's too long in the minds of some of those who are making the offer. And at this point, let me distinguish a very important point, and that is those making the offer do not comprise a unified bloc. And to make this into some sense for you, think of concentric circles. On the outer edge are China and Russia. And what China and Russia share with the rest, all of them share one thing, and that is their desire that Iran not gain possession of nuclear weapons. And you can go down the list of reasons why. Certainly one of them, the fear that Iranian possession of nuclear weapons would spur an arms race in the Middle East. Until this past week, Russia and Iran have supported that, but have opposed the imposition of sanctions on Iran. In a second circle are France, Britain, and Germany. Those three countries also share this notion Iran should not have nuclear weapons, but do approve the use of economic sanctions if necessary. And in the core, the hard core, is not only the United States, which is part of this group of six, but also you need to bring in Israel. Israel is in the hard core. And what the hardcore shares, and the other six do not, is that the United States has not taken the military option off the table. So it not only agrees that Iran should not possess nuclear weapons, it not only agrees on economic sanctions, but it says in addition, if necessary, military force should be used. Israel's a special case. Why? Because the Iranian leadership has threatened to wipe Israel off the map. There is a precedent of Israel in 1981 when it felt threatened by the growing nuclear capability of Iraq to go in preemptorily and wipe it out. So there we are, and what has changed in the last week is that Russia and China have accepted the argument of the other six that Iran should not have several months to come up with this response. It's a reasonable offer, it's a generous offer. If they're serious, they will engage. The condition of engaging in negotiations over this package is that Iran suspends its enrichment operations. And what the Europeans, and even more so the Americans, would like is that it's an open-ended suspension. And when you get to the sort of hardcore, what some American officials say is, well, it's not forever. Maybe in 30 years, if the mullahs are gone or whatever, Iran might be allowed to resume. But for the foreseeable future, they have to suspend. And then there are degrees of hardness on that position. I think the Europeans would say suspend. Suspend is suspend, and the American, that is the Bush administration, would say full suspension, that is, even the centrifuges stop spinning. And that's of some interest, because when these stop spinning, they become destabilized, etc. So, in this past week, the Russians and the Chinese have now joined the consensus that the Iranians are not serious, they've had time enough, they haven't responded. The fear is that after 3 months, then they'll come with different conditions and they'll just spin it on and they'll stall. And so Russia and China have joined the consensus to take the issue to the Security Council. And that was what was supposed to happen. It didn't happen because of the violence in the Middle East and the preoccupation of these countries this past week has been in trying to stop the violence in the Middle East. But absent that, there would have been very serious meetings about drafting a Security Council resolution which would insist or call upon Iran to end its enrichment. And then you get to the more technical questions. The U.S. would like to see that under Chapter 7 of the Charter. That's the chapter with teeth, mandatory under international law, which sets the stage for force eventually to be used. The Europeans, especially the Chinese and the Russians, would rather have it under Chapter 6. I think I've gone longer than my 10 minutes, so I will end with that and look forward to your questions later. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John, to set the stage for us, and that was great historic perspective, recent history, that is. Our next presentation is going to be made by Kathleen Thomason. Kathleen, if you can come up here, and I'll just say a few words about her background. She's a president-elect of the Physicians for Social Responsibility. She's a medical doctor. And this group works to advocate for an end to nuclear weapons and the use of war as a foreign policy tool, and is launching a national PSR campaign on the health effects of our energy dependence on fossil fuels. She's a local internist and resident educator. She has been a coalition builder in the peace community and has produced community events for peace, ranging from International Shadow Project on the Hiroshima Day to Peacequake. She also educates to reduce the use of toxic chemicals that have global significance. She has worked within the city and county on advisory panels ranging from West Nile Prevention Task Force to water treatment policy decisions. So she's been involved quite a bit in a lot of different areas. So, Kathleen, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Can I stand up here and just talk? Is that okay with you, Dan? Or do I need the mic? Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and there's lots of different sides to interpretations of the various sorts of things that have gone on. I just want to make two plugs. One, Hiroshima Day commemorates the only use of nuclear weapons, which has been by the United States, and we had an event on August 6th to commemorate that. It's a Japanese-American park down at the waterfront. And as far as the need for oil and why we, the U.S. and others, may be more interested and concerned about Iran is because of the oil, and we'll be holding a conference in November on that. I think it's important to have some perspective and to really understand what some of these questions are. And the first is, why does Iran want nuclear weapons in the first place? How close is it to weaponry production? The advantages for a diplomatic solution? Has it complied with the IAEA or not? And how sincere were prior diplomatic efforts that were mentioned that we'll talk about? What are the consequences of attacking Iran, one of my great fears? And, do we really know enough? I don't think I have an answer to that last one. Basically, the U.S. involvement in Iran has been long-term, at least in terms of my lifetime, and that we were very concerned about oil back in 1953 and Iran's association with Russia, and the CIA overthrew Mossadegh through actions then and imposed the Shah of Iran, who reigned in Iran. And I know I'm not telling you folks anything new. The revolution occurred in 1979, of course, and there were a variety of sanctions that occurred at that time, a variety of actions to try and get the hostages out of the country that were unsuccessful. But the reasons and some of the concerns that Iran has today are its safety, are its security, and that, of course, is the major function of any government, whether it's our own government or any other country's government. And so their fears include the fact that In there, between the Iran and Iraq war, was the U.S. helping? Was the U.S. complying with use of chemical weapons and so on? The fact that Clinton imposed additional sanctions in 1993, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, of course, is a big threat to Iran. The fact that Israel holds uncontrolled nuclear weapons in the region as the only other country in the region with nuclear weapons. And that the U.S. has continued to refuse to offer guarantee of non-invasion. And then lastly, if they develop nuclear weapons, such as North Korea, will they be sanctioned internationally? Will they be accepted like Pakistan was eventually in 2001 by the United States? Or India in this last year, in terms of being outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty? Will that be accepted on the world front? And I think Iran is very open to being sensitive and hearing what is out there on the world's opinion, at least from the reading that I have done on this area. Obviously, the Non-Proliferation Treaty controls the nuclear weapons development of many countries. 187 nations are signed onto this treaty. And, of course, the ones that are not are Israel, Cuba, India, Pakistan, have never signed, and North Korea recently withdrew. That's fine. That's fine. Basically, what this treaty says is that there are nuclear states, including the U.S., Britain, France, China, and Russia, and then there are non-nuclear states. And the non-nuclear states have the right and to access nuclear power and developing their own nuclear power programs under this treaty, with the idea that they then will agree not to develop nuclear weapons. And so that is the basic idea behind the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. There has been various bars that have been set before Iran and other countries that say, well, you agree to NPT, but then there's additional protocols, and then there's other sorts of things along the line. And they signed the indefinite extension of the NPT in 1995. They implemented additional protocols in 1103 that came along with this discovery that they had been trying to develop nuclear power and had not disclosed that in spite of being a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They suspended conversion of uranium and enrichment of uranium at that point in time. They feel that the demand for permanent suspension is in violation not only of the NPT Treaty, but also of the Paris Treaty, which is what was signed with the EU, saying we will engage in continued negotiations, but that this is a voluntary thing that we're suspending uranium enrichment, and that if we feel that you are not complying with this, then we will go back to enriching uranium, which we feel is our right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Okay? So by law, they are allowed to enrich uranium. Obviously, the caveat to that is that they are open to safeguards. Safeguards meaning that things are not going to be allowed to be stolen, that they openly declare what their facilities are. And under their additional protocol, they agreed to snap inspections, and they allowed 20 other visits at very short notice beyond the requirements of the IAEA additional protocol. They've had over 2,700 inspection hours in their country. And it's very important to note that in spite of what you may read in the newspaper, the IAEA, which is the ones who are doing the inspections, never cited noncompliance as a factor in referring them to the Security Council, and has never said that they are under violation of the two major portions of the NPT Treaty. Okay? So why do many people, including the United States government, feel that they have no right to enriching their own uranium and developing a nuclear power? Well, they, as you used the word, cheated on its NPT obligations in terms of reporting the acquisition of nuclear technology. So they acquired nuclear technology on the open market. They acquired some from HQCON's whole arena from Pakistan. And they confessed about this in 2003 when certain developments were found, and leaks potentially from opposition parties within Iran who wanted to stop this activity. Do we need sanctions? Well, basically, I just wanted to sort of frame that whole thing in terms of how these every single word in each of these treaties means something very specific, and every single word is negotiated because these treaties are felt to be the ability to maintain one's own security. Okay, and I think in Iraq, the concern from Iran's point of view is that Iraq did allow a lot of inspections. There wasn't any quote smoking gun, any found nuclear weapons, and it was invaded anyway. And so they feel very threatened. If we totally expose what our whole program is, what's going to happen? Okay, so they really have a major security threat. Dr. El-Baradi, who is head of the IAEA, made a statement in March that sanctions are not a good idea. We're not facing an imminent threat. We need to lower the pitch and tone of our rhetoric. Nobody has the right to punish Iran for enrichment, and we have not seen nuclear materials diverted to a nuclear weapon, but we're not saying that the program is used exclusively for peaceful purposes. We haven't been able to determine that. We have learned a lot about the Iranian, what's going on there in terms of the nuclear development, but there's still a lot of work we need to do. At that point, IAEA said we do want to refer them to the Security Council only because we really feel we need to put more pressure on the government there to show good faith. In other words, to improve their ability to show that they're going to negotiate in goodwill. And I think, as you mentioned, that there's a lot of sense in the world that there hasn't been negotiations in goodwill. And so some of the things that to show goodwill that El-Baradi states would be helpful includes any one of these: reestablish full and sustained suspension, reconsider the construction of the heavy water research reactor. A light water research reactor does not create the kind of uranium and therefore plutonium that can be used for a nuclear bomb, but a heavy reactor is, and they are in the process of considering construction of a heavy water research reactor that ultimately could produce the uranium for a nuclear weapon. They could also ratify and implement the additional protocol, in other words, go back to the previous agreement that was agreed upon in 2003, and implement other transparency measures requested by the IAEA group. So the big question is, how close is Iran from producing nuclear weapons? Well, I'm quoting here John Negroponte, who is the head of our intelligence agency, who says that at the shortest time that Iran could develop its own nuclear weapons is 4 years. Okay? So there's many concerns about where's the crisis? You know, where's this absolute imminent threat? And there's a variety of opinions about what that might be. Basically, it's because they primarily have only those P1 centrifuges that Dr. Damas was talking about, and that they don't appear to have any of the more high-powered centrifuges that will create more uranium more quickly. They only need to enrich, as they did, but they only enriched an incredibly small amount of uranium and announced it in March, 2.5% for fuel. But the enrichment has to be greater than 70% to produce a nuclear weapon. So one of the things that's different about Iran compared to Iraq and when it was bombed by Israel is that they have undertaken to create a variety of locations for their nuclear activities. So that there are several centers in Tehran. The two that are most concerning for the IAEA are in Natanz. I'm probably saying that wrong. Thank you. And Isfahan. That planned heavy water production plant is in for Iraq, A-R-A-K. So there's a variety of locations is basically what I'm saying. So that again, remembering that Iran is four times as large as Iran if you're thinking about any sort of attack. The United States has refused to negotiate directly with Iran. And they actually, it's felt by some people in the peace organizations, that the U.S. really did undermine these European negotiations by not supporting them, by still continuing to threaten. Military is not off the table, and, you know, that sort of rhetoric that the United States uses, similar to the rhetoric that the Iranian government is using. So there was a concern that that negotiation was really not done in good faith, so to speak. The incentive package of this year, as I won't repeat, is basically a full package with the U.S. on board. But again, there are preconditions, and the preconditions are that you will suspend all enrichment activities, period, for us to come to the table to negotiate this. And there's a number of groups that agree that that's appropriate, and there's other groups that say, you know, to get to the negotiating table, let's not put any preconditions on it. Let's let them look at this program, come to the negotiating table, really negotiate this, and then have them agree, which allows, of course, a government to take a lot more faith. Again, there's obviously two sides to that in terms of whether people believe that's going to happen or not if you don't get the original baseline agreement for suspending all enrichment activity. Because of this long, prolonged thing, as you mentioned, Russia and China are now more in the court of saying, boy, they're really not playing ball here, and we may have to go to sanctions. So that's kind of where we're at now. Obviously, diplomacy is what everyone, I'm sure, in this room would argue for. We need the advantages to that. For the U.S. to be engaged in a very real way is that, of course, it's going to have much more international credibility. Obviously, the U.S. Messed up pretty bad in terms of not having adequate intelligence before it invaded Iraq, without having real reasons for invading Iraq. So its credibility on the intelligence scene is more of a problem. Further threats by the United States, again, when the underlying sentiment of the Iranian government is that its security is threatened and the biggest security threats are Israel and the United States, that further threats along those lines decrease the ability of diplomacy to work. And lastly, and possibly most importantly, there are many people that feel that there isn't any military solution at all, period. And I will quote first Seymour Hersh, who wrote an excellent article in April of 2006, printed in the New Yorker, with leaked information from the U.S. military that they were very upset about the potential of the U.S. using a nuclear bomb on Iran. And it's an excellent article for people to read. And so PSR and a number of groups said, oh my gosh, we're talking about using a nuclear weapon preemptively against a country that now, as far as all intelligence says, does not have a nuclear weapon, and what would happen if we did something like that? Because these are hardened bunker areas where these potential research and development of technology are located. And to set off two bombs in Isfahan and Natanz, as you can see here in the middle of the country, creates a radiation shadow that covers over half the country. Obviously, downwind are many other countries, that a million people would die from these small nuclear weapons, that over 10 million people would be affected by radiation. So the use of nuclear weapons by any country should be spoken out against very, very strongly. It is just reprehensible to even think about doing something like that. Again, this is the data I was talking about. There's actually more radiation from a bomb that supposedly is going to burrow because it throws up more dust, which carries more radiation longer downwind. Of course, there wouldn't be any standing medical facilities for any of this kind of action. I never thought I'd quote the Heritage Foundation, but let me quote the Heritage Foundation for you here. Multiple analyses by James Carafano say there is no good military option. Okay. Retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Sam Gardner, who is an expert in simulations, did a fabulous article in the Atlantic magazine that you may want to read. That after this effort, I'm left with two simple statements. You have no military solution for the issues in Iran, and you have to make diplomacy work. So I'm hoping that our elected officials are listening to these people who are experts. I'm not the expert here, but that are listening to these experts, that it is not going to work to use a military solution. It is a large country. It has got a lot of mountains. It has a good standing military, unlike Iraq did at the time of the invasion there. It can use embargoes on oil exports, and what we know what that would do to the economy worldwide. It has the potential to attack anything going in or out of the Straits of Hormuz. It can foment further civil war in Iraq, which it has not done. It has not done at all. In fact, it has done a lot of work in Afghanistan to help the people there from the military actions that have taken place in the last 20 years. As in Iraq, after it was bombed by Israel in 81, the potential for hiding nuclear activity is phenomenal. The South African said to the United States and IAEA, we can hide all kinds of stuff from you if we really wanted to do nuclear weapons. Okay? The South Koreans were found out. The South Koreans are allies, not the North Koreans. But they were working on nuclear weapons. And through negotiations, again, diplomacy and negotiations, that they decided not to continue their nuclear weapons. And even Libya. Okay, Libya was working on the same kinds of programs that Iran is working on, and negotiations there worked as well. Okay, so we have a lot of precedent for continuing with diplomacy, continuing with negotiations, and so I really feel that we need to work, and, you know, from our point of view, we can probably only influence Oregon, but we really need to let our elected officials know that we are reading this stuff and that we want them to vote intelligently and to encourage our government for negotiating and diplomacy. Russia has offered to enrich uranium and ship it to Iran and have the accepting nuclear waste. That is a good face-saving kind of activity that might be part of the negotiation. Part of the negotiation that was agreed upon with this package, which was very interesting, was an Israel agreement to be involved in a discussion regarding a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East, which is also very exciting potential. So lowering the bar for going into negotiations with Iran with the full intentions of having it work is really kind of the only place we can really see. So, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tonneson, for that wonderful presentation and great PowerPoint presentation. A lot of good data there. Our final speaker this evening is Dr. Afdadi, Gudarz Afdadi. He's a political analyst, a writer, a radio producer, voice of the Middle East. Most of you probably have heard him on the radio. He's also a human rights advocate and peace activist by choice, and he's an engineer and educator by profession. He's a contributing member of the University of Columbia's Gulf 2000 group, a think tank which focuses on the Persian Gulf, and it works under the supervision of Gary Sick. Gudarz Afdadi has a PhD in Systems Science Transportation Engineering from Portland State University. He's taught engineering and IT courses at PSU and the University of Phoenix. He resides in Portland. He's been working in the civil engineering field for the past 25 years, 10 years as a structural engineer, and the last 15 years in the field of transportation engineering. He is a traffic engineering manager for the city of Vancouver, Washington. Without any further ado, Dr. Afdadi.
Good evening, and thank you for the opportunity and for coming such a on the eve of the hottest day of the year to Portland State Cool Room 236. Well, I'm trying to
really accomplish after the narrative that John offered and the Pop walking comments that Catherine had. What I'm trying to do is kind of bring it into Iranian political scene and give it a little picture of what is really going on in Iran and why it is happening the way it is happening. And also I've been asked to make some comments about Iranian presidents because apparently that's part of the question, and some would argue that if, for example, he was not the president, things would have been different. For those of you who know about Islamic Revolution in Iran, for the past 26, 27 years, this hostility between the United States and Iran has always been there. I mean, if you looked at the dates that Catherine probably noted on, President Clinton in 1993 imposed sanctions, full sanctions on Iran. What was the reason for that? There was no nuclear ambition at that time. There was no discussion about it. Iran was coming out of an 8 years of war imposed by Iraq and supported by the United States and many of allies. Intelligence information about Iraq, about Iranian military, was being passed on through Saudis and through Kuwaitis and through Americans to the Iraqis for continuation of an 8 years of war, a kind of trying to make the situation worse. Iran came out of a so-called Islamic Revolution, which was a popular revolution in Iran at the time, and instead of being able to deal with internal problems, they had to kind of respond to all these imposed atrocities on the country, and they had just kind of finished that war. It was a ceasefire. The reconstruction had just started in the early 1990s. And what was the reason behind this sort of sanctions? As John mentioned, at just the airplane, for example, parts that are being sanctioned. It does not only include Boeings and American airplanes. A major part of Iranian air fleet are Airbus aircrafts, which is a European, French, German, Spanish manufacturer. But part of the engine for those are coming from U.S., are McDonnell Douglas engines and are sanctioned. So they cannot really purchase any of these equipment. The Iranian oil industry is totally destroyed because technology is still from 1979 and even older than that. The equipment are totally rotten. So Iran, that could produce about 6 million barrels of oil every day, now is around 2.5 million barrels. So when you put all these situations together, all these atrocities, then you have question to ask. And when the government, for example, Iranian government, the previous one, which is so-called reformers, President Khatami, they were negotiating with Americans in kind of a sort of good faith. They have abandoned the enrichment program for more than 2 years. They have committed themselves to accepting the European package, the first package of 2004. But there was really no movement toward resolving the whole situation.
Yes, indeed. We hate to have to break in right here, right now, but hey, it's 7 o'clock and it's time for the Good Time Show with Reggae Bob.